Under the skin. Hey, everybody. I would like to welcome Benji Eisen to Under the Scales. How are you, Benji?
Never better. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing great. I'm talking to Benji out in, you're in California somewhere, I know, but where?
I am in the Dog Patch, which is a neighborhood in San Francisco.
That is amazing. And I don't know the last time that we were actually in the same room together, but wherever that was, it was watching fish, because Benji is a massive fish fan.
That's true. The last time I saw you actually was outside. It was in San Francisco. It was outside the Bill Graham and for those shows. And I think some fan was asking you about your favorite lyricist. And I answered for you that it was Billy Joel.
And of course you would be right. Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, in my head, like in the back of my head somewhere, probably the words Tom Marshall were about to come out. But then you answered for me, thank goodness, because that would have been embarrassing. So, Benji, you're in the 300 Club as well. And I was kind of like David Steinberg and a few other people. Does everyone that has been to 300 plus fish shows kind of know each other?
By default, maybe. It's like, you know, we intimately experience the same thing together. Maybe intimate's not the right word, but I feel like I don't know if it's a club to celebrate versus a something anonymous club, you know, like the 300 anonymous club.
You don't want to admit to wasting that much of your childhood?
Yeah, totally. Or, you know, I might as well hand fish my ATM card at some point, you know, and just be like, here you go, just make my life great.
you know? Right.
All joking aside, I think after 300, you definitely know a lot of people. The parking lot, you know, I heard someone once say something like, it's a small world, or it's a large world. It's actually a large world, but a very small parking lot. Ah. You know, and so something like that. I think the way that they put it was more poignant.
But we all start out small, or something was how it ended.
Yeah, but we all start out small. Exactly right.
I don't know if that quite contextually worked.
300th time around.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Totally.
Second time. 300th time. So I'm gonna bounce immediately out of chronological order, Benji, without really introducing who you are yet. I just want to tell what people might know you currently for, and that's writing an amazing Grateful Dead book with Bill Kreutzmann. And it's called Deal. And so it's Deal, My 3 Decades of Drumming, Dreams, and Drugs with the Grateful Dead by Bill Kreutzmann and Benji Eisen. And I'm about halfway through. I tried to read it in Mexico, but on the way back, I slept, and on the way there, I was too excited to read. And there, I struggled and got about halfway. So you should be proud of me. But an amazing book.
I won't spoil the ending. Then I actually haven't finished it myself.
Well, the ending is I know you're joking, and of course there's the sad part, but it's not necessarily an ending because the music just keeps continuing as we all know.
Yeah, that's true. Very much. In fact, I just had lunch with Billy and his wife yesterday, and he's got so much more music in him and so many more cool things he's doing. It's amazing.
That is really, really fantastic. Well, first of all, I should ask, how did you write the book? Is Bill and you kind of writing, or is it you interviewing Bill and then later transcribing it?
Well, you got to read the fucking book. No. Can I swear on this podcast?
I think so. We might have to put a check mark next to explicit or something like that when I launch it.
I like check marks, so it's mm-hmm. cool. Mm-hmm. So the way that we did it was I basically, you know, setting out to do it, I didn't know how it was going to go. And it was trial and error in the very beginning. But it was I went to Hawaii, where he lives, on Kauai. And we just started spending our afternoons together for months at a time, in which I had a little recorder and I would, you know, I tried to put together a timeline. Of course, anything that he did with The Grateful Dead is so well documented that I could easily put together a timeline.
Right.
But, you know, going back to his youth and also going outside The Grateful Dead was a little bit more difficult. So I would pick his brain and we would sit by his pool, drink wine at noon. And, you know, maybe.
It sounds so, so wonderful. Like getting the most amazing stories by. From what at least seems like in this book, an amazing storyteller.
It was an amazing experience. It really was. It still floors me. And it's led into some beautiful things as well. But itself, it was like we would literally, my days are pretty much, you know, wake up in Hawaii and casually make my way over to Billy's house where I would get to ask him every question I ever wanted to know about The Grateful Dead and then some, because it's literally, I mean, I think it's, I joke with him about this all the time, but I think I know him better than his ex-wives at this point.
he's got a number of them, like four or five,
he does. He does. And no more. His current one is the one he should have been with his whole life.
Great.
But it's, you know, so we would talk and we would joke and then we would go out to dinner and, you know, it'd be him, his wife and I, and we wouldn't be talking about his life anymore. But all of a sudden we'd be talking about something else, or, you know, sometimes I'd be telling a story or whatever it was. His eyes would light up and he'd remember something and he'd be like, quick, you know, write down this note. We got to talk about this tomorrow.
Would you ever like pull the recorder out, or was that was that enough, like taking a note and then asking him later?
A little bit of both. I would take out my phone sometimes. I like to ask him a few times sometimes because, you know, with memory, it's like if I ask him three different times, he's going to tell me it three different ways. But the truth will always be. And he was very truthful, you know, like at least according to his memory, he was very truthful. And that, you know, we all remember things from our own perspective.
Yeah, of course.
But he was never, you know, afraid to admit stuff. He was never afraid to, you know, to just, you know, because my philosophy with him, I always said, Billy, let's get it all down and then we can take out if it doesn't feel right, you know, but let's just get it all down. So we did that and we had a transcriber that we, you know, I'd send the audio files to. And, you know, keep in mind, this was a 3-year process. And
Years.
And so, I mean, the first 6 months was most of the interviews. And then we would still talk, you know, about it afterwards, but that was mostly the writing part. And so for the interview part, we ended up going down to Belize and to Costa Rica at one point.
Because Hawaii wasn't exotic enough.
Exactly. And you know, we would have these epic talking sessions, and the way that it worked too, like I tried a few different methods without really even telling him I was going to try these methods. I read about memory and how, you know, like the more you remember something, sometimes the farther away it gets from how it actually was. So I would try to access these memories in him that he hadn't actually recalled since living them. One way to do that was, we had some of Owsley's cough syrup or whatever you want to call it. And I played Europe 72 for him in his living room. And it was, I'm pretty sure, the first time he really listened to Europe 72 since being there. And he started crying, you know, at one point.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, and we would listen. We fast-forwarded through a number of the songs. We fast-forwarded through the songs that, you know, the same songs that any fan would fast-forward. He would just be like, next. And then it would get to, like, Birdsong or Dark Star. And, you know, would have these. And suddenly he would have this memory that he had of Jerry or of any of them, and that he hadn't had for a long time. And immediately the recorder would come out. And, you know,
now, what would he do for drums in space? Would he sit and listen and hang on every note, or would he kind of go through that fast forward?
Oh, no. We went to dinner once, and it's funny. I actually thought about Fish during this experience because when I first discovered Fish, I was in college, and I remember making my friends listen to You Enjoy Myself. This must have been the first month or two that I was into the band. And we were in my car right in front of the dorm, and I wouldn't let them leave the car until the vocal jam ended.
Because You Enjoy Myself can be like painful for new fans, the vocal jam.
Yeah, totally. But it also, like, if you leave halfway through, then it's almost like walking out on a story before the, or, you know, before the punchline or something. It just seemed like I needed the completion. And Billy and I were driving to dinner one day in Hawaii, and I happened to have a Dead CD. It was like the Spring 90 Bod set, which we listened to together. We listened to that a lot, actually, because it happened. It came out. It was released during that time, and it's a really great Bod set. And not to get sidetracked, but Billy actually recommended to Mike Gordon that he listens to the Spring 90 Bod set to really get a feel for the Dead at their best. But at the Arena Dead at their best. Okay. You know, it's the big, you know, the limited edition Rhino multiple CD set. I think that so we were driving in it, and so I happened to have a CD and, you know, one of these the Dead CDs from Spring 90, and Drums in Space came on, and we get to the restaurant and I'm starving, and we park the car, and Billy's like, "Where are you going?" And, you know, I was like a little kid. I was like, "Yeah, nowhere." You know, and so we stayed until the end of the.
Do you think he like remembered where it was going and wanted you to hear a certain part, or do you think it was just more like a respectful thing, like you don't leave in the middle of my big part here?
No, I think I think he was on the edge of his seat for what was coming next.
He was re-listening.
Yeah, there's no way that he remembered that, because it was a random Drum in Space from Spring 90. Apart from, you know, I listened to a lot of Grateful Dead with him, but that's because I would put it on. I also played him a lot of Fish and some Trey Anastasio band too as well.
Wow.
He loves Tab. But,
really?
Yeah, because of the horns and the, you know, it speaks to him, I think, a lot of those, a lot of the feeling in those psalms. But, wow. I would play him stuff. I played him Spandrel too. I definitely would play him music that basically not to play him music, but because I wanted to hear stuff, you know.
Right.
When we'd go on like camping trips and stuff, I'd be like, "Well, I want to hear this, so I'm going to play this." And it was really cool to hear him once in a while. I'd be like, "Hey, can you put on some more of that, you know, that Grateful Dead?" And it'd be like, "Yeah, of course." We listened to some of their best, you know, renditions of things ever. And he was always so thrilled to hear it, because it's not something he does a lot.
Right, right. I can't imagine, after living it, putting it on all the time.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And his friends, actually, we had some parties where his friends would come over, and I remember at one of them, as an experiment, on the TV screen, I put on some live DVDs of the Dead, and he was, you know, immediately got... His attention went right to it, and his friends kept on telling me, they're like, "You know, he never does this." And I'm like, "Yeah, he didn't do it. I did it. I put it on, but he was, you know, so it was really cool."
That is really, really cool. Well, one thing that kind of affected me, or one thing I noticed, I should say, and I wasn't sure if I was kind of being trolled by you, but I thought I saw a couple Fish references, and one of them that struck me almost right away, Bill was talking about, I guess in the late 80s, scuba diving for the first time with Jerry. And he had said that we didn't know where we were, we just knew that we were far across or far away from the forest from the multi-beast that is the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. So the way that the process worked was, so we, you know, we recorded all these conversations over a long period of time. In fact, our transcriber said, "Do you guys realize that you sometimes, you know, you'll ask the same questions?" And I said, "Well, does he, you know, and I'll tell the same stories." And I'm like, "Well, does he tell the stories the same?" And the guy's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Great." You know, because it was a long process. And so we took all of that, and, you know, Billy is a great storyteller. But the very first chapter, I tried just transcribing it and kind of taking myself out of it and stitching it together, his answers.
Right.
And it didn't flow, because writing it in a book form is a very different skill set than telling a story at a party.
I see.
You know, for your friends. And so I Billy and I established this bond of trust, in which it was his stories, my words for the most part.
Okay.
And the way that it would work is I would go home and I would write these things at night and bring them to him the next day. And to his credit, from what I understand, a lot of people when they write books with celebrities or musicians, the process is different. It's like songwriting. There's no blueprint for it. There's nothing, you know. And I think that with a lot of people, if they were to write it in their words, the subject would read through it and be like, okay. With Billy, I insisted and he insisted. It was very hands on. We would sit there and, you know, go over every comma, go over, you know, and I used to tell him sometimes, he would say, look, you know, this word doesn't work because it's not actually how I felt.
What would he do when he came upon a multi-beast then floating in the middle of the sea of words?
So the multi-beast just swam right by him unnoticed. And I had a feeling that a few other things would as well. So I remember, you know, like the dire wolves from Game of Thrones was a Grateful Dead reference. Right. I know that people have thrown Grateful Dead references into things since the Grateful Dead became a phenomenon.
So you didn't mind throwing a couple of references back at him?
Yeah, exactly right. And I knew I wasn't going to point it out to him. I don't know if to this day if he knows about, because it was.
How many would you say there are? Because like I said, I'm only about halfway. That one struck me, but I don't know if I sort of sensed a few others. Is there more than one?
I think you sensing it is a good way of describing it, because I sort of, there are some that I allude to. I think at one point I say in and out of focus, in and out of focus.
Yeah.
Which would be like, you know, time turns elastic reference, but at the same
but not
time.
Really, really. Yeah. Right, exactly. You know, that kind of reminds me. Did you ever hear that guy, Dan Greenhouse on MSNBC? He would weave in fish references into, you know, a live financial newscast.
Well, and the thing is writing about the drummer from the Grateful Dead is so different than financial newscast that I was able to. I figured, you know, here's what I thought. It was conscious. I thought if somebody picks up on this, awesome. And, you know, like they because if I was to read, you know, someone's memoirs and I picked up that it had nothing to do with fish. Per se, I would be ecstatic to see some references. And at the same time, I made sure that the deadheads that don't know anything about fish whatsoever, or at least wouldn't pick up on their lyrics.
Right.
I made sure that it would read the same. So if you don't know it, it doesn't, you know, like multi-beast, for instance, they might just be like, okay, cool, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you don't think twice about it.
No, it kind of makes sense in that context. Like, you could just skip over it. You know, what I appreciated about it, I mean,
it's not like saying rye, rye, rocko, Marco Espondolus while talking about breakfast.
Exactly. So I'm kind of a dead noob, as you might know. I saw them five times with Jerry. And two or three of those was with Trey. So he kind of turned me onto it before I was onto the Dead so much. But I read Rock Scully's book, so I know a little bit about the history. But this was kind of, I learned a lot of great things from this book. Some great stories are in there. I kind of didn't know, for example, that they had a house in New Jersey briefly. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
everyone
yeah,
knows
absolutely.
About that house on Haight Street.
Yeah, for sure.
And then there's a few interesting things about like Bill roughing up a promoter who wouldn't pay them before they got, I guess it was Rock Scully who then took over the duty of collecting money.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was totally, yeah.
Interesting stuff like that. But some of my favorite was talking about, you know, the first album that they recorded didn't really come off so great, and they said they didn't really like the sound of it. Then the second one that Bill still calls a masterpiece that I had to finally actually go and listen to, believe it or not, I think for the first time, Anthem of the Sun, and the way that they recorded it just by kind of cobbling together and piecing together multiple live shows and pieces of songs and layering songs and stuff. To me, it is incredible, and he's right. To me, it's unbelievable.
You know, that brings up another thing I never thought of before until right this moment, and that's that there's fish references that aren't references, and that there's a lot that the Dead did that fish was on a time, you know, they're on this like time space continuum with, where they really there's some you know, sharp differences, of course. Different time periods, different generations, but there's a lot of really cool overlap in the two bands' histories.
In terms of recording albums and not?
Yeah, just in terms of everything, just in terms of the way that, you know, both bands kind of blaze these trails. Have that are on different mountains but similar paths, or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use.
Right.
The other thing about the book, Tom, before I forget, is I forget what page it is now, but if you lick the corner tab of the book, it really comes alive. But clear your schedule for the next 8 hours.
That's hilarious that you said that, because I'm gonna call out my friend Scott, who I didn't know him very well, and sent me a book. And I had young kids at the time, and basically that was the instructions. But the instructions came 10 days later, after my kids had been messing with the book for a while.
You're going to have some very bright kids. Illuminated.
Well, yeah,
illuminated.
Well, let's hope not, maybe. I don't know, or maybe so. I'm not sure. Yeah. But a great book. I'm wondering, you interact with Phish, and as a Phish writer at times, like for the Rolling Stone a few times, were you ever able to get a copy of this book into Trey's hands or into any of the band members' hands?
Yeah, I handed Trey a copy personally, but he had already read it by the time I did that. I sent one to Mike. I sent a package to the Phish office and to try to get them to all of them. But with Trey, after writing Deal, I became Bill Kreutzmann's manager for a period of time. Through fairly well.
Really?
You know, like, yeah, it was just a very surreal, it's one of those things that's so surreal, it doesn't seem surreal, you just kind of do it, you know?
Were you working in conjunction with Pete Shapiro at all, or did that come later?
Yeah, so Shapiro, Shappy's an old buddy of mine, I've known him, you know, since the caveman days, so he and I would talk every day, in the months leading up to Fairly Well, but I had a plan with that Billy and I and his wife kind of came up with over dinner talks about, you know, all these different ways that we could celebrate the 50th if all of the members didn't agree to doing a reunion. And that spilled over to a living room meeting in Bob Weir's living room. You know, I realized, you know, you always hear about the Grateful Dead that as strong-headed as they all are, meetings, Jerry would become the leader by default because nobody would really take the ball and run with it.
Okay.
And so we're at the meeting, and I had called the meeting, and all of a sudden, I wasn't planning on opening my mouth at all. You know, and all of a sudden, Bobby's looking at me like, okay, well, why are we here?
let's make the leap for the audience. Who reached out to Trey? How did he first find out about it?
I don't know, because I've actually heard a few different stories, and I don't know which one's true. I think that it was happening in multiple levels. I think the band reached out to him personally,
okay,
and then I think management reached out to management.
Okay.
But backing up, so for Trey, when, you know, fast forward, not backing up, when fast forward to the rehearsals for Fairly Well,
sure,
and I'm walking in, and the one thing that Billy was always really good about was he would always introduce me to people. He was always very cognizant of that, like a gentleman. And on the way there, he said, who do I need to introduce you to? And I said, I know everyone there except Bruce Hornsby and Trey. I've met Trey. I've talked to him. I interviewed him for Rolling Stone. But I didn't, you know, I was like, he wouldn't know me. And we go into the rehearsal room. Trey's there playing on his Languedoc. And you know, looks up, sees Billy, and runs over and gives him a big hug. And Billy was just about to introduce me when Trey's like, "And you're Benji?" And he goes, "I want to tell you, I love the book. I love the book.
Wow.
And so I almost in a case of what Tourette's syndrome, I like blurted out. I go, "Well, the one mistake in the book is about Phish."
And what is that? What is that?
It's Red Rocks. I fact-checked everything in the book so many times, you know, especially with dates and things like that. And yet when talking about Billy sitting in with Phish at Red Rocks, you know, and I was just like, I know what year that happened. You know, like I was there.
Right,
and I was off by a year.
The wrong year got in the book. Okay.
The wrong year got in the book. And I told that to Trey, and Trey said he didn't even notice that himself.
What's the right year and what year got in the book?
Well, I'm going to make the same mistake again. It was 2009 and 2010 okay. were the 2 years we're talking about.
We'll leave it one to, of the, we'll, yeah, one of them is the right year.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear Bill playing any kind of drums apart from like practicing for the Dead?
Yeah, you know, Billy and I went down to Belize to get inspiration for the book, and I was writing the third chapter down there, I think. So this was early on in our writing process part, and you know, he chose Belize because he wanted to go scuba diving. And the waters were mucky when we were there. You know, his wife was there, and we all kind of were a little bit sick. It was right after New Year's. And I had just seen fish for New Year's. And I think actually, you know what? He did too. He was in one of the boxes at MSG with his wife.
Which New Year's would this have been? 2014?
This would have been 2000 and New Year's 2012, actually. Oh, so yeah.
12 into 13?
12 into 13,
okay,
yeah.
Right, okay.
And I didn't see him there because, you know, our plan was to meet up in Belize 2 days later.
Nice.
And I get down there and, you know, we had a wonderful couple of weeks down there. And one day we decided that we weren't going to do any work. We were just going to have fun. And we had some mushroom pizza, and things started really coming alive. And so I decide we rented this house that was right on the beach in this really small village in the southern part of Belize. And I ran to my room I think I was going to get something, or maybe I was going to get my laptop and write something down for the book. And I hear and I had been going on the roof every day to run, to exercise for about 20 minutes, you know, in the mornings.
Okay.
And I would put on fish, of course. And so I had everything up there, and I had downloaded the
why run on the beach, you know, in Belize when you can run on the roof of a house.
Totally. When you can look at the beach from afar and be like, yep, that's nice.
Okay.
Must be nice down there. Oh, no, it was a great view up there. And okay. So
I trust
you. Yeah. And also it's running on like, you know, a harder surface.
Okay.
So, but anyone passing by would have been funny because I'm just, you know, looks like I'm pacing back and forth.
Doing circles up on a roof. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, Billy went up to the roof at one point and, I'm in my room, and then I take out my laptop, and I hear this, like, you know, this banging on the roof. I'm like, what is that? And then I realize that it's Billy. We found this bongo drum in the house, part of the rental house. Like, it was like a VRBO, and found these bongos. And so, you know, I knew that they were around somewhere. And I heard him playing on them, which is funny. He doesn't really like bongos. Yeah, that was Mickey's thing. And yet I distinctly heard him on there. And as I'm walking up, I was like, oh, and there's music playing. And it was the Sand from the New Year's run. And I wasn't even sure if he knew what he was listening to. I think he just pressed play.
Oh, wow.
And his shirt, like he peeled off his shirt, and you know, like, and he's like playing these bongos, and he looks at me, and he was like, you know, having this intense moment. He's like, man, this is so good right here, you know,
<That's fantastic.
laughs> in total ecstasy. And I was just like, I was over the moon.
That is great, and yeah. And I am now too, because it was Sand.
Yeah, totally. Sand. Yeah, exactly right.
I didn't want to divert you from, I was thinking that like maybe you got to witness some of the Fare Thee Well rehearsals and maybe heard Bill like playing something. But did you see any of the Fare Thee Well rehearsals?
Yeah, I saw all of those rehearsals.
All of them.
It was very, again, another surreal thing in that my office, we had these little pipe and drape dressing rooms. If you saw Fare Thee Well, it was on the stage itself. It was these the back of the stage. Every member had their own little pipe and drape area where they could kind of retreat to for some privacy. And the rehearsal was inch by inch recreation of what we did on the stage. So those pipe and drapes are there, except that they were where the audience would have been. They were like where the very front of the stage would have been instead of behind the stage. And Billy's was in the center, and I would go in there to be on my laptop to, you know, do work stuff for him for Fare Thee Well. And whenever I'd peek my head out, you know, the only thing, it was just the drape, you know, that's it.
Right.
And it was right in front of where Trey's, it was like between where Bobby and Trey's positions were on the stage.
Oh my God. So you're essentially completely on stage with the band.
And not only that, but it was awkward at some points because I would like in a really funny way, because I would be like, you know, emailing, trying to like print out documents to, you know, for hotels or whatever it was, you know, like just, you know, basic stuff, forms, paperwork.
And you'd be like, Trey, could you please put more paper in the printer?
Yeah, totally.
In the middle of a jam?
I would go out and I'd be thinking, you know, I'd have to run to the bathroom or I'd want to grab a drink, and I would open up the drapes and my head would be so miles away from there, and all of a sudden it'd be Trey playing Slipknot, and I'm like, oh yeah, whatever. And walking by, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh yeah, like that's happening, you know. So
any song in particular, like you know, from that moment that just totally knocked you out that you can remember?
Foolish Heart. When Trey, because I, you know, and I got to talk to Trey a bunch about how, you know, like I felt that I always use myself as a litmus test with Billy, and then, you know, with other bands that I've been working with, I'm a fan, you know, I'm always a fan, and so therefore, I don't think musicians have a fan mindset a lot of times. And so, you know, for instance, and I'm sure you've experienced this with Fish, a lot of times what a musician thinks is a great show, the fan doesn't, and vice versa.
Yes, very much, you know? So. Yep.
And so I got to kind of, you know, I saw myself as getting to do, I think Bob Weir even said at one point when we were all making points in a meeting, after I made a point, he said, I represent the fan vote, you know, you know, arguing to get the floor general admission, you know, like that was, okay. I made that argument, and because that's what I want when I go to the show, you know, is a general admission floor.
Right.
So I can meet up with my friends and have the chance to move around, and the people that don't want that get seats, you know, simple as that. It's really simple.
Yeah. Fish kind of figured that out after a while as well. I remember the old days, Madison Square Garden would have seats on the floor. Not anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I told Trey, you know, at some points I got to have that sort of fan voice and say, look, you know, like it's cool for you. What's really going to make these shows is to hear you play you without, you know, not trying to play Jerry, which was what his, you know, it was what he was trying to do to begin with. And I didn't want him to know how into Fish I was, because if I told him I've been to over 300 shows, I mean, if anyone told me that they had followed me around for 300 days, I would probably get a restraining order. You know, this was a different context too, because I wasn't being a fanboy with Trey. I didn't want to ask him about, hey, you know, when you did this, because it was a professional setting in a total different environment. And I wanted to, you know, respect that and to bring my best to it.
Right.
So I think over the course of a week, he kind of, you know, I kind of revealed a little bit more and more, because we would talk about, you know, sometimes in the breaks that they would take in between, you know, rehearsing, things would come up and I'd reference something that, like, he was trying to, I'll give you an example. He was trying to tell Billy about how awesome the project Surrender to the Air was. And I let it slip that I was there for those shows,
oh, okay,
you know,
right.
which those shows were
immediately
like,
betrayed yourself as a fanboy.
Totally. Because those shows were like, you don't get to those shows if you just like bouncing around the room, you know?
Like, you were like, yeah, I'm kind of here with Bill, and let Trey figure out that, you know, later that you were a huge fan.
Yeah, because it was like, I didn't want him to feel like I was going to ask for his autograph and then like ask him about a million different, you know, things that like he's probably bored about talking about. And instead, like, I had a job to do and I wanted to do it. And that part of that involved, you know, interacting with Trey. And so I wanted to keep that professionalism up.
Right.
But at the same time, let him know subtly that sometimes when we were talking that, hey, like, I know exactly where you're coming from.
Was Hornsby, you know? Was Hornsby, and now this kind of betrays my not being a Grateful Dead fan as much as you, obviously, but was Bruce Hornsby an obvious choice just because he'd been their keyboardist for a while, or was that also up for debate?
It was the obvious choice. He was the first choice. It was the obvious choice because he was a member of the Dead, and you know, he wasn't a full-time, long-standing member of the Dead. But when he played with them, he definitely, you know, he toured with them for, you know, he played a number of shows with them, and that's part of their history. Yep. And he's such a phenomenal, you know, such a phenomenal musician and player.
Right.
That it was sort of the no-brainer.
And a great singer, too, I might add, which helped, you know, for the current state of the band in a way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I wanted him to sing more as well as Trey, obviously.
Yeah, I think people did want, yeah, exactly. A little more Bruce, a little more Trey.
I talked to Trey about that, actually, because he felt that it was kind of interesting. It was like almost like how I felt about him. He felt about his interactions with the Dead and that he didn't want to overstep his boundaries. He felt like he was the guest.
Of course, not.
And so I think we all wanted him to sing more, and I was vocal about it. No pun intended. I was vocal about it with him, and then I was like, you know, it would be great if he could sing more. What about these? And he, you know, he agreed. He wanted to sing more, but he also was like, I can't really. You know, I can't, that's not really my position to ask for that. And
so the way he did it was have all those Let Trey Sing shirts made.
Yeah, totally. You know, which Bobby then wore. So.
Right. That was hilarious. I should add, that was not Trey that did.
Yeah, that's totally. No, but he was all in favor of it, you know, and it was great getting to talk set list with him. And all that stuff, you know, like it was a neat experience for me. Cause like I said, I very much withheld the extent of my fish knowledge, from him. And then it was fun when I got to give him little glimpses. Right. It wasn't until the very end that I gave him that I really exposed myself in the biggest way. But up until that point, I at one point, I looked at the guitar that he was playing, and I was like, didn't I see you have you had a maple guitar once? You know, I'm not up to date with all my nicknames for the guitars.
And I'm barely there. I just kind of got there by interviewing Trey about his guitars.
There you go.
Yeah.
that's the person to talk to about his guitars, by the way.
It's not you?
No. But I remember talking to him about,
holding someone prisoner? I hear thumping.
What you're hearing is a storm window because it's storming outside, which here means rain and wind.
Oh wow!
But it's this rattling in the window.
I thought you were simultaneously like throwing clothes into a trunk because you're going somewhere tomorrow.
I'm just beating the sloth. beating the sloth.
Teach him a lesson. Yep. So when you got to Chicago and the band, everyone was ready to go. Everyone's all practiced up, and now it's time for sound check. How was that? Like just being there with no one else in the stadium.
Well, that was the first time that I had a chance to take a breath in over a year. When we started planning Fairly Well, the book hadn't come out yet. And so we had to do a publicity tour. And I remember doing this publicity tour across the country in which Billy and I would do these question and answer segments and, you know, kind of this comedy routine in a way and by default. And at the same time, going back to the hotel room at night and dealing with Fairly Well stuff until, you know, 3 a.m.
Wow.
And so I hadn't had a chance to take a breather. And, you know, we were doing shows with Billy and the kids I hadn't had a chance to enjoy any of it. When the book became a bestseller, we were doing the day that we found out, we were doing a show at the 9:30 Club with Billy and the kids. And, you know, we found out and he told me, he got off the phone with the publisher. He told me, and I was like, okay, great, but we still need a sound check right now. You know? The rehearsal, I remember walking in, I think it was in Chicago. I remember walking into the stadium, and it was the day that they were rehearsing Standing on the Moon.
Standing on the moon, where talk is cheap and vision true. Standing on the moon, but I would rather be with you. Somewhere in San Francisco, on a back porch in July, just looking up at heaven, endless crescent in the sky.
Yeah, Standing on the Moon, and Trey was playing it and singing it, and I took out my iPhone at one point, and I was just like, I got to take a photo of this of him on the Jumbotron. I'm the only one in the audience in an empty stadium watching, you know, Trey sing Standing on the Moon. And even though I had seen that in rehearsal, it wasn't real. You know, right. It wasn't real. There was actually a better moment that I just remembered. Mark Allen is Bruce Hornsby's manager. He is the Jerry Garcia estate manager, manages Dirty Dozen Brass Band, a number of other clients, and I'm going to out him right now. He's also a Fish fan and an old friend of mine. And I think when we bonded, you know, we never imagined that we both would be working in the Grateful Dead world, you know, in some capacity.
Right.
20 years later, you know, and another Fish reference.
20 years later.
Yeah, and so
I think he just do it naturally.
I think so. And so he, you know, we were sitting in the we were standing in the back of Levi Stadium the day before the first show. It was a tech rehearsal, and another old friend of mine, Dan Berkowitz, was like on a golf cart driving around, and of course he now does CID
presents.
Yep. And so there was a lot of you know, old Pete Shapiro, who we all were old friends, you know, Matt Bush, we were friends for years. And then to have us be somehow a part of this thing that brought us together in the first place as fans was really, really special. But I was on my phone dealing with some rapid fire emails that had to be taken care of so fast that I couldn't even go back to my production office and write them down. I had to respond to them. And Mark Allen comes up to me and he goes, are you seeing this? And I look up and Trey is shredding in St. Stephen.
Oh, wow.
And the arena is empty except for working crew. And I looked up and glanced at it, and without even breaking a smile, I kind of nod. I go, yeah. What's the matter? Like the lights are working. I was like, you know, looking at the Jumbotron. I'm like, yeah. He goes, no, are you seeing this? And I was like, yeah, everything looks like it's going, you know, everything's fine. And he goes, no. Look at what's happening. And I'm like, oh, you mean Trey is kind of shredding to St. Stephen right now?
Wow.
And so, yeah, that was a
it's hard to get out of your work mind sometimes.
And that was a great moment, though, you know, because if you had told me when I first, you know, if you went back in time and told me when I first was on Fish Tour, summer 94, I would have believed you because I would have been like, why are you coming back from the future to tell me this if it's not true?
That's true.
But I also would have been, you know, I would have been amazed. I was amazed.
I think pretty much everyone said the same thing to their best friend when they're standing there watching that. How surreal seeing our two favorite bands and Trey, you know, in the Jerry spot for the dead.
Well, for you, it must have been something else entirely, because this is, you know, your childhood friend,
right?
That you've been through, you know, all the highs and all the lows with. All there's no, you know, Trey's not. I think for a lot of people, it's almost there's like a Wizard of Oz thing where it's like the man behind the curtain.
So Trey is the Wizard of Oz. I get the analogy, and yeah, I'm lucky to know the man behind the curtain. But the reason I'm stopping the interview right here is because that marks the spot where we kind of change subjects from the Grateful Dead over to Phish. And believe me, Benji is quite immersed in the Phish scene also. Enough so that this interview stretched on for over 2 hours. My sweet spot for how long I want my podcast episodes to be is 40 minutes to 1 hour. And I'm already past 44 minutes with this one. So I'm going to continue it next time. Please tune in for Benji 2 next week on Under the Scales. Also, let me say, a few of you are apparently counting along at home, keeping track of how many times I ask the 300 Club question. You know, if you've been to 300 shows. It took me by surprise how many people mentioned that question to me. I guess I asked David Steinberg and maybe one or two others, and now Benji. And I might be obsessed with that question, I guess is what it's indicating. If you're wondering, I'm going to keep asking it until I've asked it 300 times. Oh, and Benji, if you're listening, that's not how storm windows are supposed to work. Not even close, man. You are doing it wrong.